Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
March 5th, 2014, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Features Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, another major daily newspaper cuts its photography staff. We'll talk about some big changes at the Orlando Sentinel. The Fox station in St. Louis is adding a new tool to its news-gathering arsenal, a boat. Is there enough news to cover on the river to give the station a competitive advantage, or is it just another gimmick? And it's the selfie scene around the world. This photo was retweeted nearly 3 million times, or a record, but who owns the rights to it? Ellen DeGeneres, the Associated Press, actor Bradley Cooper? I'll ask our panelists. But let's start with some changes going on here on our local media scene that may have an impact on the television viewing audience and will definitely have an impact on us here at the School of Journalism. Last week, Dean Mills announced Stacey Wolfel will leave his post as news director at KOMU-TV to head up the new Jonathan Murray Documentary Journalism Center. If you'll remember, Murray, known for his pioneering work in the reality television and documentary genres, gave the university $6.7 million to start the center and develop a degree program. After more than 24 years in the role as news director, it'll be a tough one to fill, one that executive producer Randy Reeves will assume on September 1st. Reeves has been at the station since joining the faculty in 2003. Talk for a minute about the role of a news director in a newsroom and the kind of impact that person has.
I mean, it depends on the market size, of course. I mean, in some larger markets these days, a TV news director is more about the budgets and the money and the promotion necessarily than the news coverage. There are people below him that handle that or her. But in this instance, in a smaller market like ours or a training place, the news director really sort of sets the standards, the policies for what kinds of stories are going to get covered. You'll remember we talked a week or two ago about the coverage or lack of coverage of the folks coming in, Westboro Baptist Church people coming in. That was a decision made by the news director, and those kinds of policies can make a difference in what people see on the air.
And I think, you know, what you're going to see here is because, you know, Stacey has been there for such a long period of time. You're talking 20-something years. Yeah. And now you have Randy who's coming in. And Randy, who was trained here at the School of Journalism and has worked under Stacey for a while, I think you're going to see some continuity there. But I'm pretty sure that at some point Randy's going to try to sort of build his own reputation as news director at KOMU. So you won't see any initial changes, but I think down the line you may see some subtle changes.
And that's not an easy thing to do. I mean, think about it, written slightly larger here at the Journalism School, where we have Dean Mills, who's been here for 25 plus years, and he's stepping down. Do you want to be the person coming in after that to build your own reputation, your own legacy? Very difficult thing to do. And that might be why, you know, Stacey Wolfel wanted to step aside and take on this new venture. It's nice to reinvent yourself after a while, but also it's a chance to show a side of yourself that you can't show as a news director of a commercial television station. This documentary program is going to be quite a bit different. And I think that anybody who suspects that because he's been a longtime traditional commercial TV news director that somehow the documentary program is going to be traditional, I think you might be surprised.
And I also think, you know, with Randy moving into that, I mean, he's a really big on First Amendment issues, on journalism professionalism. So you're gonna I think see more of that coming into what KOMU does and what the student reporters out there and also behind the scenes how they put their newscasts together and the types of news that's going to be on air.
So if you're a member of the audience of our viewing public that's out there, what should you be looking for? What should you expect? What should you hope for?
Well, like I said, I think initially you're not going to see very much difference, but I think in the long run you're probably going to see more technology. I mean, KOMU is moving in that direction anyway, but then I also think you're also going to see a different style.
I think you're also going to see that even more so than Stacy, Randy Reeves is going to have to deal with the changing relationship between the networks and local stations and the expectations that people have for local news. Does there need to be more in-depth coverage and less focus, even less than KOMU puts, for example, on sports? I don't know. Are they going to have to worry about whether or not the networks sever their relationship or change it radically between them and local stations and what that means for the economies of local TV news operations? A lot of big changes might be coming.
Okay, well, we talked a little bit about the development of the documentary program. We've talked in the past about how documentaries are important in this community. Let's talk about a controversy swirling over one of last year's true-false films, Blackfish. The film produced by Magnolia Pictures and acquired by CNN last year explores the concept of keeping killer whales in captivity for entertainment. It set off a national debate and resulted in significant backlash for SeaWorld. SeaWorld has long called it one-sided and claimed that it's the product of animal activists. Well, now the park is requesting the Department of Labor investigate the employment of Laura Padgett, claiming she broke the federal government's ethics codes. What's behind SeaWorld's claim here?
Well, I think basically what they're saying is that Laura Padgett may have provided some information to the producers of the film Blackfish in violation of federal regulations, and they use that information to put together the documentary. Now, there hasn't been any evidence to clear evidence to show that she did this, but the fact that she's actually shown up at several of the premieres of Blackfish at several film festivals, and those pictures have gone out on social media, I think calls into question whether or not there wasn't some sort of relationship there.
So let's talk about the ethics of that, because that's something we see at True False every year. That's one of the hallmarks of that film fest right there, is that the directors, the participants in those documentaries are here to have discussions and to talk about the work after screenings. So is the claim that Padgett should not have been one of those people involved?
Yeah, I think you've got to take this and break it down a little bit more, because there is no allegation by SeaWorld that Padgett was involved as a secret source when that documentary was being produced. In fact, the director of the documentary says that that no one from the federal government would respond, including Padgett, to request to be in the film. Now, whether or not there was a relationship after the film was released, I mean, maybe there's an ethical question there, but that doesn't go to whether or not Blackfish itself was somehow tainted by this relationship.
I think part of it, too, is you have to remember that there's a legal proceeding going on right now. So, and it's also being, I guess you could say, it's being in the court of public opinion now, and it's being tried that way.
CNN running it sometimes 2 and 3, 4 times a weekend.
Exactly. So now you've got the lawyers for SeaWorld not only trying to fight this in court, they're also trying to fight it within the public arenas. And this is one of the tactics that they're going about using to try to show that some of what Blackfish is, the producers of Blackfish said and demonstrated in their film may not necessarily be right.
And, you know, my opinion about whether or not the documentary Blackfish makes its case compelling, I mean, my opinion's no better than anybody else's, although I must say that it certainly has attracted enough of an audience, as you suggested, partly because CNN picked it up and runs it all the time, but partly, you know, whether they meant to or not, because SeaWorld provided additional oxygen for the stories that have been written about it. I mean, they decided to go after them rather than a lot of companies do when they're the subjects of negative news coverage or documentaries and just kind of laying back and hoping it'll blow over and the public will forget. SeaWorld is not letting the public forget.
And I think part of the issue here, too, is that if SeaWorld is not allowed to have its personnel work with their marine life in the ways in which they've done in the past, then those shows may not be as well attended mm-hmm. as they are. And that's a lot of money. Now that's where a lot of this is going.
Okay. Okay. Well, I know the calendar says it's March, but it still feels like we're in the throes of winter, which makes this next story, kind of funny to talk about. It's about setting sail in St. Louis aboard Aqua Fox, KTVI's news gathering boat.
There are so many different ways to use this to give, again, that unique angle. We're used to seeing stories from the ground. We have Skyfox. We have Bomberate Automotive Skyfox. But we have never had the capacity to bring people the sights and sounds of our community from the water. And this is something that I think just is such a unique differentiator that we'll be able to do with you.
A unique differentiator. The boat is courtesy of State of Mind Water Sports in Hazelwood. Legitimate news gathering tool or gimmick?
Oh, I mean, it could be used for legitimate news gathering. Was that the intent? Oh, come on. They announced it at a boat show in the middle of the winter. It's got the sponsors' names written all over it. One of the things that they didn't talk about in that live shot was the fact that the station has to give the owners of the boat 24 hours notice before they can take it out. So much for covering spot stories. Maybe they'll be there for fireworks or any other kind of promotional opportunities that are available to them. But this is not serious.
Well, I'm pretty sure you're definitely going to see it out on the Lake of the Ozark and going up and down the Mississippi and Missouri to Party Cove. And that's but this is clearly a gimmick. I mean, as Mike was saying, I mean, when you have to give 24-hour notice, so you can't do any spot coverage, like if there really is a situation.
If there's a rescue
or something where you really could use this, you're not going to be able to do that. So, I mean, it's. I think that the use of a helicopter and promoting that makes sense because you can get to the scene faster. You can do some things.
Aerial shots,
that sort of thing. But a boat in the middle of landlocked St. Louis, I mean, yes, you have rivers. Yes, you have lakes. But I don't see this. I don't see anything like this happening at a local station, say, along the Gulf Coast or down in Florida.
Or the Great Lakes.
Or the Great Lakes for that reason.
I mean, one of the examples they talked about was, well, they didn't use it by name, but Asian carp, you know, the fish that are taking over the Mississippi and Missouri. Okay, they'll go out and show fish jumping over the hull of the boat.
They'll be able to get that one fish as it jumps as soon as they get on that boat.
I want to see the first really in-depth sort of environmental story on the Missouri or Mississippi rivers that comes from Aqua Fox.
Right.
Okay, well, we'll keep an eye out for that all summer long. 3 hours, 22 minutes. Sunday night's Oscars telecast was long, but it didn't break any records. Well, not TV records, at least.
So you are nominated. It's a record-breaking 18 times, right? So I thought we would try to break another record right now with the most retweets of a photo.
Okay.
So right now, I'm going to take a picture of us, and then we'll see if we can break the record for the most retweets.
Okay.
And then,
you should
get in here too, Julia.
Yes.
Lean in. Channing, if you can get in also. Channing. Bradley, will you come in? No, I want you in it. Jennifer, come in also.
I'll take it.
Brad, get in here.
I'll take it.
No, I'm doing
it.
Angie. Lupita. All right.
And that resulted in this, a selfie shot using Ellen DeGeneres' Samsung cell phone. Viewers did set a record, retweeting the photo more than 3 million times, creating a logjam on the social network so deep it took it offline. A critic from the Denver Post said the telecast itself was so boring people had to go to Twitter in order to look for photos and selfies to entertain themselves. But it's an interesting thing to bring up here. Who owns the rights journalistically to that photo?
Well, I mean, it's going back and forth right now. I mean, you could say that Ellen DeGeneres owns the rights because she took the photo.
Well, Bradley Cooper took the photo.
Well, okay, Bradley Cooper owns the rights. So,
okay.
But it was her idea. So is it his? Is it hers? Is it Samsung because they were a sponsor and it was one of their phones that they were using in that? Could it be the Associated Press, which actually put it out? Could it be – it could be a whole host of people. I mean, it who knows?
I will say that, you know, regardless who does have the copyright to it, you find a lot of news organizations who just, you know, willy-nilly take images from social media and use them without getting permission. And most of the time, they're going to get away with that because of fair use exemptions in the copyright law. But the AP, out of an abundance of caution and to protect its own interests when people try to use their materials without getting permission, decided to ask for permission before they used it. And that was probably a smart thing.
And I think that them asking for permission is what brought the whole controversy up about actually who owns it and who has the rights to it. But I think if AP had just ran it, we probably wouldn't be talking about it. I could be wrong, but
I have to say, though, I mean, I think it's one, it's kind of hilarious that the selfie was one of the moments. But on the other hand, if you look at the strategies that producers of live television now are doing with incorporating social media, second screen experience and all that, this made perfect sense as the first time a selfie was introduced into a program like the Oscars. And I have to say, I also think it's really hilarious that there are news stories being written about whether it's a controversy that she was using a Samsung phone to take that picture and behind the scenes was using her iPhone.
Talk a little bit more about that.
Samsung is a big sponsor, as you said. Yes. And so when she went out to do this selfie, she did it with a, looked like a Galaxy, a Samsung Galaxy Note 3 phablet, one of the big phones, mm-hmm. right? Because they were the sponsor. She was also tweeting pictures from backstage using her iPhone. So obviously Ellen DeGeneres uses an iPhone in her day-to-day interactions, but because there was a sponsor, she used their device. The only reason anybody cares about that at all, I think, is you have a lot of tech fanboys for Apple who decided we're going to write a story about mm-hmm. this, or producers, online producers at news organizations that wanted to ride the tail of this Oscar story as far as they could for more page views.
And I mean, the thing about it is it's also product placement. I mean, you know from the commercials and everything else that Samsung is a sponsor, but in this regard, no one's thinking about the camera until the story comes out. I mean, or the phone that she was using and that sort of thing. And then all of a sudden, as you said, the iPhone fanatics sort of got involved by saying, wait a minute, we got some product placement here too, because she was taking pictures backstage using an iPhone and we're not a sponsor, but hey, we can get involved as well. And it's all centered around the Oscars, which, as a lot of people know, is the second most watched television program outside of the Super Bowl. So there you go. You get a lot of eyeballs for your product, and then it just carries over into next day's stories.
There were a couple of other social media moments, if you will, during the telecast. Mike, I know you were excited.
Well,
about
I mean,
one.
The one I really enjoyed is most folks probably saw John Travolta introducing Idina Menzel, the Broadway superstar from Wicked and lots of other shows. She was singing her own song, Let It Go, from the movie Frozen, which won the Oscar for Best Original Song. And he John Travolta, called her Adele Dazeem. I don't know where that came from. So Slate, deciding we know how to build on, you know, some buzz around a story, created one of their name generators called the Travoltify Your Name Generator. Plug in your name and it'll come up with some crazy mispronunciation of it. And that video and that website have been really big in the past few
days. And we can go ahead and link you to that on our links blog if anybody hasn't seen it yet and wants to Travoltify themselves.
Or Ahmed Shmochka, I think was Amy Simon.
That was me. Well, last spring we talked about the Chicago Sun-Times laying off its entire photography staff. Well, four of those staffers were hired back this week as part of a contract settlement between the paper and the Chicago Newspaper Guild. This at the same time the Orlando Sentinel told its photography staff that their jobs were gone and they had until the end of last Friday to reapply for new positions that would be more video-centric in nature, aimed at getting more video to the paper's website. Folks hired back won't find out about the status of their jobs until the middle of next week. At the Sun-Times, it was a cost-saving measure. Is that what's going on here, or is this something different?
Well, and the Sun-Times is also an issue involving their union, right? Mm-hmm. And so the fact that they hired back these four photographers says more about the negotiations that went on between the union and the management more than anything, probably. But in Florida, I mean, they're not actually getting rid of any total number of employees. They're just redirecting their visual resources to people who can do video too. And you can argue about whether that's a good or bad thing, but economically it makes perfect sense for a newspaper when videos online are driving a heck of a lot more traffic, advertiser relatable traffic and audience engagement than photos are.
But I think you're going to have a different staff as opposed to a reduction in staff. Mm-hmm. So some of the people who probably didn't embrace video as a part of that staff may not be coming back, but then you'll have others who will come in and be able to bring that kind of technology, bring that kind of journalism to the online product, which is where the direction that most newspapers are going into, including the Orlando Sentinel.
So last spring when we found out about the Sun-Times, we were all discouraged by that, and our industry as a whole was discouraged. is this something for us to be upset about, or is it something to get energized about and see it as maybe a move into a direction?
I mean,
forward?
Orlando is taking arguably a more nuanced or positive approach to it. I mean, they're not getting rid of a bunch of folks. They are saying, reapply for your jobs. If you have the interest and the chops in doing the video as well as photography, you still have a job here. They're not advertising outside the paper. They're letting the people who are there apply for those positions. I think that's a positive development.
I think it's a positive development, but I think overall what the public should be concerned about is what type of product are they putting out. I mean, this is more geared toward what's going to be on the website. The question becomes, what are you going to get in, on your front lawn, on your front porch, in terms of the print product? And I think that's where you're starting to see some issues, because if you have more of your photographers out doing video, then what's going to be the quality of the actual print product you're going to get those photos.
The because still photo
exactly because you're stretching those photographers into doing more work, and there's only a finite amount of time in a day to get to be able to get that product out.
Okay, our next topic is one Mike brought to my attention after it sparked a discussion in one of his classes this week. It's about something that happened at another journalism school, University of California at Berkeley. The school decided to cut ties with Mission Local, one of three local news sites it used to train students. Among Dean Edward Wasserman's explanation for the decision, the site's needs for attention to marketing, audience building, community outreach, and other publishing activities is, quote, not what we really do. Mike, this statement and the decision, it's raising a lot of eyebrows out there.
Yeah, I really don't have an opinion about whether or not it was right for the school to sever its relationship with this sort of hyper-local news website. I mean, they know the situation there better than I do. But I do think that the justification that Dean Wasserman gave and that you sort of paraphrased there really gets at the heart of what we need or want to do in journalism education these days. It's okay if the J School at Berkeley says, we want to focus on reporting. We don't want to talk about revenue generation or audience building or partnerships or special events, any of that stuff. But somebody has to train today's journalists and the other media professionals that support journalism on those things. We do that, mm-hmm. and we have a very large strategic communications program in our school, and a lot of the other programs also focus on those things, including some of the classes we teach.
You and I teach.
But I really think that if you're saying, you know, we don't have the talent or the time or the expertise, and it's not within our mission at Cal Berkeley to teach our students that, somebody better.
And the problem with making that kind of a statement is that your competition can use that against you. I mean, if you're out there, if you're supposed to be one of the best journalism programs in the country and you're not doing this, then chances are students who want to do this or who understand the importance of having this in their toolbox, mm-hmm. in their resume, being able to do this once they finish their academic career, they're going to go somewhere else. So I think that's the way in which he sort of described this may come back to hurt the program in some ways.
I mean, you have to have your own strategy. You have to figure out what your niche is, and that's perfectly okay. You can even justify it by saying maybe journalism schools spend too much time talking about the wrappings and all this other stuff and not enough time training people to be good journalists. I don't happen to believe that you have to have one or the other, but clearly I think they're putting themselves in jeopardy in terms of their appeal anyway.
Well, and right. I would agree. There needs to be some kind of mix, even if you want to focus on reporting or editing. You need to be able to also get your work out there and understand what it takes to get it seen.
Well, the thing, what's really happening is that as journalism is changing, you're not having jobs for people coming out of journalism programs that are structured the same way. You don't go and work for a particular newspaper or a television news station and you're there for forever. So you're more of a freelancer in a lot of ways, because, I mean, if you go back to the story we just talked about with the photographers down in Orlando, the ones at Chicago Sun-Times, mm-hmm. they're sort of being looked at as freelancers. as independent contractors within an organization. So you're going to need to know all the other skills that, that they were talking about in order to be effective.
And I don't think it's just about tactics either. I mean, I think there is something to be said for paying more attention to the audience. It's one of the reasons that as an institution, journalism has had some trouble, you know, in terms of its reputation with the public in the last several years. We ought to be focusing on the audience and not just how they react to what we produce, but how they can help us to have a conversation about what makes for better journalism.
Okay. Well, we're going to talk about the other paper in Chicago for a second. Chicago Tribune reporter Gregory Trotter was supposed to cover Billy Corgan's ambient musical interpretation of Hermann Hesse's novella Siddhartha. The performance took place at a tea house the former Smashing Pumpkins frontman owns in suburban Chicago. Corgan told Facebook followers the performance would run between 8 and 9 hours. Trotter said he was turned away at the door, told by Corgan's publicist that Corgan was upset about a column written by another Tribune writer that mocked the concept of that concert. That columnist was Missouri School of Journalism alum Rex Hupke. And in that column, he wrote that Corgan has often struck him as more than a little pompous, and his tea-infused Siddhartha Palooza reinforces that impression. In the interest of full disclosure, I should mention Hupke was a colleague of mine at the Chicago Tribune, and I did an internship under the publicist, Lissa Christman, when she was an executive producer at WBBM-TV in Chicago. What we really have here sounds like a duel between two creative types.
That's pretty much what you have. I have to be transparent as well. Rex Hupke was one of my former students, so I do have a history with him. Mm-hmm. But basically what you have is a back and forth, and it's pretty much caused some problems for the employer of both Rex Hupke and the reporter who went out. So you've got some issues here that probably there needs to be some conversations away from social media to probably deal with what's going on here. But it's not – it happens quite often, but not as public as you're seeing in this case.
And I mean, I suppose there is a kernel of a journalistic issue there as to whether what one person on a staff writes, you know, should be used by a news source to keep the organization from covering you. On the other hand, I mean, Rex was writing a humor column, and it was a very snarky humor. It was a really great read. I enjoyed it. But I'm not sure I would be making a big deal out of it. And I happened to notice that Rex is also, he and the Tribune Company are trying to syndicate his column beyond Chicago. So maybe there's a commercial motive there as well for making this bigger than it otherwise was.
But should Billy Corgan have a thicker skin at this point, somebody who has been out there as a performer for decades at this point?
Well, I would think that he would have a thicker skin. But you never know when an artist will all of a sudden just decide, well, wait a minute, this has gone about as far as I'm going to let it go, and I'm going to fight back. I mean, he fought back in this instance. Next week, he could be trying to get the Tribune to actually run some of his material. So you never know how this is going to play out.
I mean, Billy Corgan is a great artist, or was a great artist with Smashing Pumpkins. I haven't followed his career since then. But an 8-hour synthesizer-laced interpretation of Siddhartha, I don't know.
It wouldn't even take 8 hours to read Siddhartha.
Somebody would enjoy that. But, you know, also, if I read that column that was written by Hupke, I'd have to have a pretty thick skin not to take offense.
Well, I'd have to have a thick skin to actually go through 8 hours of that. So,
And one of the things Rex had said he was going to do in response to that 8 hours was an 8-minute interpretation of some Garfield cartoons on his Twitter feed. So it was definitely a back and forth. Well, we're just about out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half an hour with us. You can read about all the topics we talked about today, find more background, check out our links blog to do that. You can find it under the talk show tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave comments or questions for us, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show and to Pat Akers for handling the audio. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week. Mike's going to be away on some university business, but we've got some special surprises for you that you won't want to miss. We'll see you then.